The following is a Cartoonerific Studios presentation.
Welcome to Cartoon Fun. It's Cartoonerific. Yeah!
Well, welcome to the Cartoonerific Podcast, Classic Animated Cartoons. I am Brian Mitchell, and I am your host. You know, all kids love cartoons. I mean, I'm sure there's a few that don't, but I loved cartoons and puppets. I always thought it was a magical thing. It was always fun to me, and I would gravitate to it. But I think with me, I really loved cartoons, and if there was anything animated that came on during the day or prime time, I would watch it. You know, Saturday mornings were kind of tough because there were great cartoons on both stations, or, you know, because there were three stations, and there might be a cartoon that I wanted to watch on ABC, and there might have been something on CBS that I wanted to watch at the same time. So sometimes I'd have to kind of flip the channel around, see what was a little bit better at the time, and then watch that. But like I said, I just really love cartoons. And somewhere around 1967, when The Jungle Book came out, that was kind of the flipping of the switch where I decided, you know, this is something that I would like to do. At least I'm interested in it. And so I started looking around for any information on animation. I wrote to the Disney studio, I wrote to Hanna-Barbera Studios. They both sent stuff back. Disney sent me back this thick packet of information on how animated cartoons are made. And thick, like a book. Hanna-Barbera sent me back a nice little letter and a photograph of the banana splits. So that was the thing with Hanna-Barbera. But anyway, but I started seeking out all different things, and I found this World Book Encyclopedia when I was going to school. There was a World Book Encyclopedia. There was a special edition, maybe just a special for the year. And in it had the making of an animated film. And it was the Bill Melendez studio. They had a bunch of photographs in it. And the photographs showed the full color photographs, by the way, of the making of a Charlie Brown movie. And I believe they were following the Charlie Brown, A Boy Named Charlie Brown. So anyway, these photos showed people painting cells and showing the animator work and the painting of the cells and the painting of the background. And it blew my mind. I was like, wow, you know, this is cool. I really like this. I probably didn't say cool at the time, but I really liked it. And so I was kind of hell bent on getting an animation cell. But I didn't know where you could get an animation cell from. I didn't even think about writing to a studio asking them because some of these studios, if you wrote to them, they'd actually send you a couple of cells in the mail. I didn't know this. And, I'm thinking back and I'm going, I wrote to Hanna-Barbera, I wrote to Disney. Nobody sent me a cell, you know? So anyway, eventually, I went to some movie memorabilia, mainly poster shop on Long Island, New York. And they had two cells, and one was Porky Pig, and the other one was something out of a Betty Boop cartoon. But anyway, they were full-color cells. And what I learned later on, even though I really liked these, we bought them because they weren't too expensive. We bought them. We had the two hanging in cheap frames in the house. I learned later that they were basically cells that were from a production of those cartoons, but they made them from black and white to color. So they basically had to produce these cells all over again in full color, and they traced the frames off of the film and then basically shot it all over again. And that's why they had all these color cells. So anyway, I had two of those. So it was an interesting thing to have. And anyway, I eventually got a hold of some Disney cells and some Hanna-Barbera cells, and that was later. And that's a whole long thing. But there were people who lived in Los Angeles that would actually go to the studios and do a little bit of dumpster diving. And what I mean by that is they would go into the dumpsters or the garbage cans from the studios. So Hanna-Barbera, DePatie Freleng, Filmation Studios, Walt Disney Studios, whatever was in town. And they would find artwork, and sometimes stacks of artwork that was just thrown out. And it could be pencil drawings, backgrounds, or cells. And so the studios, once they were done with the material, once they shot the film, these were just byproducts of the film. And so instead of just keeping them, they would just dump them. And so people would go, kids normally, would go and get a stack of this artwork, and they would take it home and look at it and really liked it. And some of those people that did that actually became dealers in animation art. Well, the person that we have on today's show did a lot of that. He actually went to the studios in his early years, and he would go into the dumpsters and pull artwork out, and he would take it home, really enjoy it. He had a friend that they would do that together. And somewhere along the way, he decided he wanted to work in the industry. Well, that gentleman is on next. His name is Robert Alvarez. He's an animation director. He's now retired, worked for over 50 years in animation, and he's worked on a lot of your favorite shows. So he's coming up next. Don't go away.
You're listening to the Cartoonerific Podcast, classic animated cartoons with your host animator, Brian Mitchell. And now it's time for our special Cartoonerific guest.
Well, the gentleman we have on today has worked on many, many of your favorite shows. He started in the late 60s as an assistant and worked his way up into the business as an animator, doing a little bit of everything. But basically, he eventually became an animation director. So, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome 6-time Emmy Award-winning animation director. His name is Mr. Robert Alvarez. How are you doing, Robert? How are you doing today?
I'm doing fine, thank you.
We had a little bit of a technical glitch before, and so it feel like we're doing the show all over again. But we were able to cover a lot of good material. But how'd you get into this whole animation thing? I know I've seen a lot of the stuff that you've posted on Facebook, which is all this wonderful animation art from these animation studios from years gone by. And tell us a little bit about that. Where are you from, first of all?
I'm originally from Brooklyn.
Okay.
And then my family moved to Glen Cove, New York. And in 1959, we moved to Los Angeles and to North Hollywood. Mm-hmm. And I've been in California ever since then.
Wow. And how'd you end up in California? Was that just a family move that, you wanted to go out to the sunny state of California? What necessitated that?
It was a family business, a family-owned business. My father was part of this business that sold wholesale art supplies. And they had an office in New York, Chicago, and Los Angeles. And it was decided that my dad would then run the Los Angeles branch. So the family moved out to Los Angeles in 1959, and which turned out to be good for me, because if we hadn't moved out to Los Angeles at that time, I don't know what I would be doing today other than being retired like I am. But I may never have gotten into animation.
What prompted you to get into like animation? What was the...
It was a combination of things. I had an early interest in comic books and comic strip art and cartoons, watching it on TV. Mm-hmm. And then what happened was once we moved out to California, I had a friend that I met in seventh grade, and he had some animation cells from the early shows of the Flintstones, and he knew where Hanna-Barbera was. So we started riding our bikes after school all the time, practically, going to the studios that were close by, Hanna-Barbera, UPA, Format Films, and going through the dumpsters and trash cans and pulling out art. And that kind of piqued the interest, because he and I both liked animation. Mm-hmm. And we both decided, like, that's what we wanted to do. And eventually we both did. And he worked in the business as well as I did. And he's retired now, too.
Wow.
But it was collecting that started our interest.
So did you just go to, like, Hanna-Barbera? Or were there other studios that you went to find the material?
Well, we mostly went to Hanna-Barbera because they tended to be the ones that threw out a lot of stuff. And we would go there. Sometimes we would go to Hanna-Barbera and UPA on one day, because it was just a matter of riding your bike from one location over the hill into the back into the valley to UPA. Mm-hmm. And we'd ride our bikes to those two studios. And Format Films was a studio that was really close to my friend's house, and it was maybe like 15 minutes from my house by bike. And so that was easy to go to. And then on some occasions, my dad would drive us to places, like to Clampett's studio on a Saturday, so we could jump into the dumpster and pull stuff out. Mm-hmm. And sometimes on Saturday, he would drive us to Hanna-Barbera so that we could go through the, you know, the dumpster and pull stuff out. So it was like any occasion that we could, we would go to these studios and just pull the stuff out of the trash and we collected it over the years.
Now, Hanna-Barbera, we know what they were doing. They were doing Flintstones and Jetsons and all that wonderful Top Cat. And let's see, Format did, I know they did the, you know, they did some Roadrunners for Warner Brothers after Warner Brothers kind of stopped making cartoons in 63. They also did the Alvin Show, the original Alvin Show, yeah, which was a favorite.
When we were going to Format, they were in production on the Alvin Show. Mm-hmm. And they also then did the Long Ranger Show. And so when we were going to Format, the one thing that was nice about Format was they actually would let you come in and watch them work. So we did that on one occasion. They were really nice. You know, we could stand at the desk and watch them draw. And so that was a good place to go to, because they were pretty friendly.
Right.
And Hanna-Barbera, you know, Hanna-Barbera and UPA were the places where if we saw artists walking down, we wouldn't even know who they were, except for Bill and Joe, because we knew who they were.
Right.
But we were just going there to pull stuff out of the trash.
Wow. Pretty amazing. Pretty amazing time. Because this stuff was considered kind of worthless, wasn't it, to the rest of the world?
Well, this was in the early 60s. We started doing this around 1961, and at that time, nobody was really that big into collecting.
Right.
Disney just had started selling cells at the Disneyland Park at the Art Corner, but no one was really into that. The other studios weren't selling any of their artwork, and they were just throwing it out because it was too much to store.
Yeah.
So, you know, rather than keep it, they would just throw the stuff into the trash.
Just dump it.
And
yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, there were probably kids like ourselves that were interested in getting this stuff, but probably very few of them. I think Tim and I are the only ones that I know of that were kids at the time in the early 60s that were going to studios and getting stuff out of the trash that eventually got into the business and worked into the business and became animators.
Right. Wow. That's pretty interesting. When did you decide that you wanted to go into animation? Because you're collecting the stuff, but when was the big...
I think when we were in high school, I know for myself, I was thinking about it already in high school. I was taking art classes, and the one art class that they offered at the... I went to an all-boys Catholic high school, which mm-hmm. was really strict, and they had this one art class, which was, looking back, was a total waste, but I wanted to get into doing animation. And after I finished high school, Tim and myself both went to Chouinard Art School for the whole purpose of getting into animation.
Right.
And we started in the fall of 67, I think. Yeah, in the fall of 67, we started at Chouinard.
Right.
And I started my first job in animation while I was still in school in 1968.
And what was that job?
It was doing assistant work on the Banana Split Show, which the cartoons on the show were Three Musketeers and Arabian Nights.
And oh, wow.
I was working at a small studio in North Hollywood called Fred Calvert Studios. And that was where I
started. Oh, wow. Wow. I loved the Banana Splits as a kid. And I think I started writing Hanna-Barbera around 1968, 69. I saw on your resume you worked on, what is it, Winky Dink and You?
Yeah, that's kind of a weird story. Fred Calvert did these, a revival of Winky Dink, and I did some work on it, and very little work.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very low-budget stuff.
Right.
But I've neglected to tell you, what, in 1968, while I was at Fred Calvert, I was in the right place at the right time, because there were two animators there, Ron Campbell and Dwayne Crowler,
mm-hmm.
who were doing contract work on Yellow Sub. So I got to work on Yellow Sub at that time in 68.
Now, that was being done in London. So I guess it was a kind of like a
it was,
overflow.
It was done in London, but they also did some, and some of it was done in, I can't remember what country, in the Netherlands. I don't know, it might have been Belgium or Sweden. I can't remember it. The problem with Yellow Sub was, I think they were fighting the clock. And the reason I got to work on it was because Ron Campbell was from Australia, and he had worked on the Beatle cartoons that were done in basically a lot of different places.
Right.
And it was the same company producing the feature. So they contacted Ron, and he was now in North Hollywood, and he was renting space in the place where I started.
Mm-hmm.
And he shared a room with Dwayne Crowley. So they were doing several sequences on Yellow Sub, and just being in the right place at the right time, because those guys tended to goof off a lot. So they got behind schedule, and a lot of people just had to jump onto the work to help out, you know, get the stuff done so they could send it back to England.
Right.
And that's how I got to work on it.
Oh, wow. So were you doing assistant work, or are you doing animation?
Yeah, just assistant stuff.
Well, that's cool.
My only memory of it is sitting at, I can remember where the desk was on the second floor of this old house, and drawing roses on the blue meanies, because it was the sequence where they do this, you know, the splotching sequence at the end of the film where they start sprouting roses and on the characters, on
right.
the blue meanies.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my only real vivid memory of it.
Wow. That's still pretty neat. I think it's pretty neat.
Yeah, it was fun.
It's a piece of history, right?
Yeah, and I used to go into the studio real early so I could go into Ron's room and go through his trash cans. So I was still doing the same thing. And anything in the trash was mine. So I still have the drawings. I have drawings from, you know, roughs and stuff that he would throw away, and model sheets and some layouts from the film.
Oh, very neat.
It was in the trash, and I just took it.
Yeah.
What's interesting is there have been long spells over the years where I didn't accumulate any more stuff, but I've never lost interest in it, and I've never not appreciated it. And now that I'm retired, I have a lot more time on my hands, so it gives me more opportunity to look at stuff that I've accumulated over the years,
right.
and sometimes acquire new stuff. So I really like looking at the art that is no longer being done the same way. I mean, nobody does cells anymore. And I still like the art. I like looking at it and having it.
Yeah. No, I like looking at it myself. I like looking at the artwork, and I really appreciate it. I appreciate all the work that went into it. It's crazy how much expertise and just technique people that were inking those cells and.
Right.
Yeah. So where'd you go from there?
I worked for Fred 1968 and 1969. And I was still going to school, too.
Right.
And then in 1970, I started working for some other guys that Ron Campbell recommended me to. And I worked on the Hanna-Barbera show, the Harlem Globetrotter show.
Oh, wow.
And then through the 70s, it was a series of working on various forgettable Hanna-Barbera shows, you know, like Harlem Globetrotters, Roman Holidays, Where's Huddles, C-Lab 2020.
Those were both primetime shows, weren't they? Where's Huddles and...
They could have been. I don't remember because I remember vaguely working on the stuff. And at the time, I was working on stuff that I didn't really care that much about. It was a job, and it wasn't shows that I really liked, but I was in the business, and that was important to me.
Sure.
So I worked on things at the same during the 70s that were also like the guys that I was working for were doing freelance for other places. So that got me an opportunity to work on some Ruby Spears shows and DePatty Freeling shows.
Right.
And, you know, so I got to work on a lot of different stuff over the time. And most of it, I would say, in the 70s was forgettable. It wasn't like anything really good.
Right. Was there any one studio that was better than another? Like, you know, maybe the atmosphere was different or maybe just you felt like the work was better? Because it seemed like, I think in the beginning, most of these studios, like Hanna-Barbera, when they were doing the Yogi Bears and the Huckleberry Hounds and Pixies and Dixies, it seemed like it was more like they're really trying to make a fun show. And it seemed like the atmosphere might have been better at that time, even though a lot of people were freelancing. I know that. And I think the same thing with DePatty Freeling when they started off doing the commercials and the Pink Panthers and the Inspectors. And
well, I liked when I finally went on staff at Hanna-Barbera. Then I started picking up. And at the start, I was just still working at home, but I was on staff. And then eventually I got a phone call from Bill Hanna, and that was much later on. Mm-hmm. And he asked me to come help him work on the Jetson feature. So that's when I started working in after that.
Right.
But Hanna-Barbera was a good place because they weren't really strict. They didn't care. As long as you got your work done on time, they didn't care what your hours you kept. Whereas the opposite was true of Filmation. Mm-hmm. Filmation was so strict, it was like a high school. And I was lucky because for the brief period I worked for them, I did not work in. And they were so strict with the people that worked in. If you were 5 minutes late, they would dock your pay and you could not make up the time. If you came back from lunch 5 minutes late, you would get in trouble. I was just listening to a story the other day on a video where some guys came back from lunch late at Filmation and they got fired because Filmation was just not a fun place to work. Right. I don't think.
Right.
And my wife, who was an assistant, this was before I even worked there. She worked for Filmation. And I don't recall her telling me stories about how great it was.
Right. Interesting. What about DePatty Freeling? Were they kind of along the same? Or you were freelancing?
I never worked in for them. I got freelance work on them, on some of their stuff, through the guys that I was picking up work from. Mm-hmm. So I never worked in. I only went there on a few occasions to drop off work and you know, just go into the lobby and drop it off. So I didn't really work in the place, but my understanding of that place was it was pretty loose atmosphere because my friend Tim, who was working, he worked there as an animator, and he told me that he would leave early because he was living down by the beach somewhere,
right.
And he would just leave the light on his desk on and just go, so it would look like he was still at the studio. And finally, one day, somebody told him, said, "Hey, look, Tim, we know you're leaving early. Just turn off your lights when you go." But they were pretty loose at DePatty,
right.
And Hanna-Barbera Filmation was the only place that I really didn't care. I didn't like the shows they were doing.
Right.
It was just a job, you know, to earn money, and the atmosphere there was terrible.
Right. Mm. It didn't seem like from the shows they were producing, they're pretty bland. You know, I mean, it was Fat Albert, He-Man. Gilligan's Planet. You know, it just seemed like it was wouldn't be a fun place to work. I don't know.
It was not. Yeah. I don't think it was. Yeah, it was just.
I'm sure somebody's going to say. I know. You know. After we do this, I'll get an email from somebody. I love Filmation. I love working there. You know. It was like
In fact, I can probably tell you who one person would, if he ever listened to this, would tell you how much he liked it.
Right.
But see, there were people there, like the directors. They had it easier than everybody else because they had phones in their office. They had an office, and they were had phones in there. Uh-huh. The rest of the people were in cubicles. And they didn't have phones. And what they would do at break time, they would announce the following people have messages, and they would announce your name, and you would run down to the front desk and get your messages, and then you'd go to the payphone. This was before cell phones existed. Wow. So you'd go to the payphone and make your phone calls. Mm-hmm. But they had a card key system where you would slip it through, and it was like a time clock. So they knew when you were there and when you were not there.
Right.
So that's how they kept track of you.
Wow.
And it just wasn't, and it's, I think some of the supervisors liked lording over the monkeys. They liked being, in charge. Mm-hmm. And you're going to find people that worked there and said, oh, it was great. But in my opinion, I didn't like it at all. I didn't like the shows that they did. I didn't like their product.
Yeah.
And I only was doing it for the money.
I almost worked on one of those features they were doing, those Disney knockoffs, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, and
I worked on one.
Yeah.
I worked on the Pinocchio one they did. It was awful.
Yeah. I think it was George Sakara, I think. I hope I got the name right. He was I was trying to get into the business at that point, and I got into Bakshi's, but I was trying to get into Filmation to work on those features because I figured that might be kind of a way in, and had to do a test, pass the test. And then basically they said, your stuff is pretty good. We can use you. And they said, call back next week and we'll give you a start date. Call back next week. Everything was basically just canceled, and they're going to finish it up with the people they had there. And basically what George said to me was, look, the opportunity isn't here now, but I think Bakshi is doing something, so give him a ring. And I ended up working for him. So
you're probably better.
Probably.
Yeah. Because I worked on the Pinocchio feature, and
yes,
Hal Sutherland was the director. And I remember you'd go into his, I still was working at home. Mm-hmm. And he'd go in and he'd hand you the stuff. I don't remember him giving you any great direction or anything like that. It's like, do the work, come back, and finally drop it off. Did that for a little while. Mm-hmm. And then I did more work for their TV stuff. And I just didn't like any of their product. I didn't like working for the people. I didn't like the studio. And but, in the business, you don't always work on shows that you like. Number one,
right?
You work where you get a job offer. And I would tell people who would come through my office, like interns and stuff, and I would tell them this all the time. I would say, look, if you only work on shows that you like, you're going to be very poor. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times you're going to work on stuff that you don't like because it's the job. It's the one thing that's available at the time. So I worked for the Filmation stuff because Hanna-Barbera was slow at the time. And
right.
So I figured, why not? But while I was working for Filmation, I was also freelancing for Deke. Mm-hmm. And then eventually, I started going back on staff at Hanna-Barbera.
Right. Was Hanna-Barbera, like when you were over there, wasn't it like 6 months on and 6 months off? Because
The industry when I started out was pretty much like that all across town. There was exceptions, people that were like the higher ups, the real important people that were, the studio was not going to lay off. But for the most part, you'd work like 6 months and you'd be out 6 months, and you would collect unemployment, or you'd go around trying to get work on a commercial or someplace.
Right.
And it was rough. And that was like that in this, when I started in the late 60s, mm-hmm. and in the early 70s. And then by the late 70s, it was getting a little bit better. And in the mid-80s was the last time I was ever laid off.
Right. Wow. I know when Filmation was doing the He-Man stuff, I think they're trying to keep people on all year round. So rather than just do a six-month thing, you know, 6 month on, 6 month off. Seemed like they're just trying to keep it going. It was good for work, but I think the industry as a whole, and I'm just trying to remember now, like in the late 80s for me, I'd work on something and then, yeah, it was pretty much I'd have to work on commercials or something else. Hopefully something else would pop up where I could do maybe some animation or layout or something. And, but it seemed like the season ran, I think the seasons were getting shorter too. I think it used to be like it would go from maybe March to August. And then I think the networks were picking up stuff later and later. And it became a thing where, you know, there maybe the shows were being picked up in, you know, in April or May and not giving these animation studios enough time really to do the shows right. I mean, do you recall that or?
Yes. When you're talking about when there was only three networks.
Yeah.
And in those days, the networks always committed to their shows at the last possible minute. And then studios would restaff up the people and you'd go to work. And, but they had people, like, for example, at Hanna-Barbera, they had people that were not laid off because they were doing stuff, either developing things or they were key people that they were going to keep around all the time.
Right.
So by the time you got back to work, you know, the shows were work that was ready. And then also in the 70s, stuff started getting farmed out of the country
right.
more and more.
Mm-hmm.
And that was what prompted the first modern strike in 78 or 79 because of the runaway production.
Right.
And it was two strikes. And, but, you know, once that door got kicked open, there was no closing it. Because
right.
to be honest, you know, like, Jay Ward started that way before everybody else in 1959 when he was doing Rocky and Bullwinkle.
Right.
When he started. And for him, it was an economic necessity because it had so little money that they went and started that studio in Mexico City.
Right. Gamma or Renmar.
Yeah, Gamma. Yeah. Yeah. And, yeah. You know, and then by the 80s, you know, there were studios everywhere. Hanna-Barbera had a studio in Australia. They had a studio in Taiwan.
That was Wang.
They had a place in New York. Taiwan was Cuckoo's Nest.
Cuckoo's Nest. Okay. I thought it was Wang, but
hey. Yeah. James Wang.
Yeah.
He was the owner.
Yes.
And it was Cuckoo's Nest. And they had a place in Manila, filled cartoons. Mm-hmm. And they also started sending work to Korea. So, you know, and now when any show that's done, if it's a 2D show, even though it's, you know, there are no cells, they still hand draw things. It's not, none of it's being done in LA, the hand, you know, the animation at all. It's all, they'll do pre-production and post, and that's it. They'll do like storyboards, models, scripts, whatever, you know, directing. And sometimes they don't even do that now. Now, like places like Bento Box has been is owned by Fox, and Fox bought Boulder Studios in Ireland, and they're sending a lot of the shows straight to the studio in Ireland, and shows that were being directed here are now going to be directed in Ireland. And I just heard from somebody who wished to work there that Boulder can't, the Irish studio isn't able to do all the work, mm-hmm. and they're sending work to South America to get done. So it's like, you know, that's nothing new. It's always, you know, they're always trying to find the cheapest way to do stuff, and that's been going on for, you know, going back to the 1970s. So that's nothing new.
Yeah, I directed a show in the mid 1990s, and it was sent to China. We actually sent it to Chicago, Star Tunes.
Yeah.
Star Tunes did their thing on it, and I tried to do some animation on it. I was directing it. And then they took it. They sent it to a studio in China that they were working with. And we got back the first act of the show, and there was a mistake. And it was a color mistake. And everything that was supposed to be black was painted red. And everything that was red was painted black. The thing looked like something out of hell. And when I looked at it, I was like, what the hell happened here? And I had to go back to them, and it was a simple error. But this is one of the problems. It's like that would have been caught immediately if it was in-house, if it was done in-house. But because of that, they had to go back and totally repaint one-third of the show, about 6 minutes, 6.5 minutes of the show, totally repainted due to a labeling mistake. So that's why I think, you know, it seems like shows will farm this stuff out and then we'll come back. And it seems like they have all the money for retakes. Seems like the money is here for retakes, but there's no money to actually do the animation, you know? So
it really depends on the studio and what their budgets have for retakes, because some places have minimal budgets and they'll stick to it and they won't let you spend all kinds of money. Disney seems to have deep pockets and they'll throw money at shows to fix them and fix them and fix them. Mm-hmm. But I'll give you an example of how they don't always fix everything. An editor once told me this story of Hanna-Barbera, that Bill Hanna was calling retakes on a show, and it might have been like a Scooby show. Mm-hmm. And he went through the show calling the retakes, and the editor said, you know, Mr. Hanna, I think there were some other things we could have called on this. And Hanna went back from the start and called and pointed out everything he could have called but didn't. And when he got to the end, he said, the reason why we don't do it, it's because of money. So, yeah, everything doesn't get fixed. Mm-hmm. But I know, like, on the Cartoon Network shows, the budget, there's always a certain amount of money in the budget. And when I would hear what that money was, it was always like, that's not anywhere near enough money. But people seem to get around that by taking other monies from other parts of the budget to fix things. Because mm-hmm. some of the guys that, well, now what happens a lot nowadays, you have guys that are showrunners that didn't come up in the system like what I did. So they've never really animated mm-hmm. and they haven't done a lot. And so when it comes time to fixing things, they wind up spending a lot of money.
Yeah.
But yeah, shows get, it all works out in the end.
I guess it does. Is there any particular show that you worked on that was like a problem show in Hanna-Barbera? And I guess meaning like the, you know, it started off okay and then it just became a disaster and you know, people are struggling to try to fix it. Yeah, good.
I don't, you know, there probably were a number of shows that I worked on at Hanna-Barbera that I never had to deal with the problems, but they got canceled because they were terrible shows.
Right.
And, you know, I think, like, I worked on the Dukes of Hazzard show, and that got canceled before they aired all 13 episodes. I worked on a show called, I think it was called Gravedale High or something like that. I can't remember. It was a guy that was from Second City, I can't think of his name, Rick Moranis. It was his show. Mm-hmm. And I remember the producer of the show coming into my office one day and telling me what he thought was the reason why the shows weren't very good. Mm-hmm. And Hanna-Barbera had what was called an 8-frame normal pause system. I don't know if you know what normal pause is.
No.
But, well, what it was is when they would record a show, if they have like several lines in a row that were good, that was a good take. But if they had like another take that was going to go in after that, you have to put a pause in. You just don't butt up the track.
Right.
Because that was going to be taken and put on mad track.
Okay.
So they had what was called an 8-frame normal pause. But it wasn't always really 8 frames. You just assumed it was 8 frames for the purposes of calculating the direction. Mm-hmm. So you knew how long the total track was. And let's say it's like 1,300... In a half hour show, it would be 2,000 feet. So if your track came out at 1,300 feet, that means you had 700 feet you could slug into the show. Mm-hmm. But if you were putting slugs between lines of dialogue, you had to account for what was originally there. So like if you're assuming there's 8 frames and you're going to put in a slug of 24 frames, a foot and a half, you're actually only putting in a foot because you're counting the eight frames that's already there.
Right.
So it's a math thing, but it's simple math.
Right.
So this producer comes in and he starts something. He goes, well, you know, the reason why the shows aren't very good is because they have this, they're putting an eight frame pause in front of every line of dialogue. And I said to him, they're not doing that. That's not how it works. I said, the reason why the shows aren't, and now this guy was also a writer.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why the shows aren't very good is because the scripts are awful. And he was one of the writers.
Right.
I said, that's why the show sucks.
Right.
And that was the put an end to him. And so, you know, I worked on a lot of shows that I thought were terrible, but it was like something you did at the time.
Yeah.
And I think most of the work that was done probably from the 70s and 80s and into maybe even to the first part of the 90s at Hanna-Barbera were not very good.
Right.
It was just like they were doing these formulaic shows that they've done over and over and over again. And it wasn't until the 90s when we had all those the guys come in from CalArts, the young guys,
mm-hmm.
and they were very creative and they wanted to do new and better stuff. And
right.
that's when we started doing good stuff. And that was also when Turner had bought the studio.
Right.
And when he bought the studio, everything changed. Because he put Fred Seibert in charge, and basically that was the end of the writers.
Mm-hmm.
And he started letting the young talent create shows.
Yeah.
And they did better stuff that had been done in the last 25, 30 years at Hanna-Barbera.
Right. I think the reason for the formulas was because maybe Joe thought he could sell more shows that way. Maybe felt if he can give him something like Scooby-Doo that, you know.
The early days, Joe was the guy that sold everything. He would go back to New York to the networks and pitch the shows and sell them.
Right.
But as time progressed, if you were around Joe, I don't know if you ever met Joe or talked with him.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, because I had a meeting once with him, and this was in the 90s when I did two shorts for What a Cartoon. And so Fred's assigned to me this one guy that was like he had brought in, and he said, I want you to go talk and meet with Joe and talk about your short. It was already a greenlit short. I was mm-hmm. like, what do I need to talk to Joe for? And you could tell Joe, it was just, he was tired. I mean, it wasn't like he was like saying these things that were not good, and you could see like his day was long gone.
Mm-hmm.
And that was true of, I think, a lot of the stuff that Hanna-Barbera did in the 70s and 80s. They just weren't doing very good stuff, and they were doing these formulaic shows. And the writers were the guys that were king before Turner came in. So they were the ones that would create stuff, and Joe would somehow pitch it or wherever how it was getting done.
Right.
But these writers were writing the same crap over and over again.
Yeah.
And that all changed with Turner.
So that's always a good thing when you have new ideas and you're doing different things. You're doing things in a different way. And I guess, how'd you adapt to that when that whole changeover was going on?
Well, at first I was kind of taken aback and I didn't know what to think. And Fred Seibert always tells the story that I gave him a hard time, but I don't really recall that. I think I probably confronted him with some issues because that's just the way I am.
Mm-hmm.
And but then I realized that what he was doing was really good because he basically got rid of the writers.
Mm-hmm.
He did hire three people and put them in positions of, they were supposedly development people, but they were worthless.
Right.
And he was letting the young artists create the material. And so I really liked it. I liked what they were doing. And I liked that work. And that carried over into what we did at Cartoon Network when we opened up the studio at Cartoon Network in the year 2000. And it was good. I think Fred is the – he created something that almost all the studios are doing today. He was the guy that started doing all these shorts as potential pilots.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, nobody was really doing pilots.
They
were writing scripts, pitching shows, and then they would do a show and, you know, they would go on the air. We started doing pilots at Hanna-Barbera.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how, you know, Dexter's Lab, Cow and Chicken, Johnny Bravo,
right.
and Dex and Powerpuff Girls all came about.
Right.
And then Nickelodeon started doing the same thing, and you know, Disney does the same. All the studios do that now for the most part, with few exceptions. Mm-hmm. And Fred started that.
Right.
But prior to that, it was a completely different system at all the studios.
I think with those Schwartz, they were nurturing those ideas. They're really, you know, they're kind of fine tuning them before they actually did the pilot. And then they would let that person do it, right?
Well, what happened is this, because I did two shorts myself. I pitched three and I got to do two of the three.
Wow.
Here's the deal. They would not pay you to do a storyboard. So like if you really wanted to do something, you had to do your own storyboard, which basically meant you wrote it, you created it, you're doing all the work.
Right.
And then you would pitch it. Mm-hmm. You would get a date for when the people from Atlanta were going to be there. And you'd go into this one conference room, and the room would be filled with like executives and then people that were there for like supposedly as an audience to supposedly laugh at it, if anything was funny. Mm-hmm. And you would pitch your storyboard. And if they liked it, you usually found out that day. If they liked it, you got a green light, which meant you're going to do the short. It was a 7-minute short.
Right.
If they didn't like it, you would find out that day, no, they passed on it. Mm-hmm. And that's how the shorts, What a Cartoon, were done, with some exceptions. Because like they gave two shorts to Bill Hanna and two shorts to Joe Barbera, but they were just like taking up space, because basically what they did were stuff that you, when you looked at them, you go like, this stuff looks like it came out of the vault from the 1980s or something. It wasn't, right. They weren't funny. You know, it was, but who's going to say no to Bill and Joe? Because their names are on the studio.
Right.
And then they had a deal for a brief period with.
Ralph Bakshi.
Ralph Bakshi.
Yeah.
He originally had a contract to do three, but he got into some kind of. He had problems, and I remember he got into the shouting matches with Buzz Potemkin, and they it wasn't working out. So he did one, and that was it, and they dumped him.
Right.
And I think Bruno Vanzetti did one short because of his name. Mm-hmm. And then there were some shorts I think that were done, especially the early ones, that were not really that good, but they didn't know what they wanted. And if you pitch something early, you were almost guaranteed a slot.
Right.
But out of those shorts came the shows, you know, Cow and Chicken, mm-hmm. Dexter's Lab, Powerpuff Girls, Johnny Bravo.
Right.
And those all went to series.
Pretty amazing. Pretty amazing. But, you know, they allowed people to actually, like I said, to nurture these ideas and put them forward and see how they would work. A lot of ideas don't even get to that stage. They don't even get to that stage. They may get to a pitch stage. And then because, you know, they're trying to sell it as a show, it doesn't even get the chance, because it's like they're too afraid to do something that hasn't been seen. But with those shorts, it seemed like because there were one shots, they were going to put them on as part of that show, What a Cartoon Show, that they could actually take some chances. And if it got some success, then they could green light it to series. So
Fred Seibert tells the story of before he did What a Cartoon, because he had to really sell that to Ted Turner to get the money to do it. Mm-hmm. Because prior to that, they had done I don't remember what series it was, and it was, I think it was the revival of Secret Squirrel or something like that. It was a flop, or mm-hmm. Two Stupid Dogs. It was Two Stupid Dogs, and that was not successful.
Right.
And so he then was going back to Turner and asking for, I don't know how many millions of dollars to do these shorts. Mm-hmm. And he turned out to be right, but he had to convince Turner.
Right.
And he replicated the same process when he left Hanna-Barbera and went to Nickelodeon, and they did Oh Yeah Cartoons.
Right.
Same damn thing. Mm-hmm. And we briefly did it at Cartoon Network, but here's the problem. What happens a lot of times now, it's not like back in the early or mid-90s. Now you get people that are development people, and they're involved. And for the most part, those people don't really know a damn thing. Mm-hmm. They're just lucky they have those jobs, because they're not really writers. For the most part, they're not writers, directors, animators, or artists or anything like that.
Right.
And they're deciding your fate, and they really don't know anything. And it's it's I think it's a lot tougher to sell a show now than it ever was. And on top of that, most of the studios now don't even want to do original materials. They want to do pre-existing IPs because they don't want to take a chance on something new, because production is way down in animation locally in LA. So it's a different world now. But back in the day at Hanna-Barbera, it was a great thing, and it really worked considering what they turned out.
Do you remember how much time you had to produce one of those shorts?
You know what? I don't remember the exact time, but it was like you probably had, well, the board, once you pitched it and was greenlit, that means your board was done.
Right.
You might have had to make some changes if they said, well, change this or change that. But then you had like probably 3 or 4 weeks at least to do the layouts, because we were doing layouts in those days on that stuff.
Right.
And like on my shorts, and I know on other people's shorts, and Pat Ventura's shorts were the same. You were back practically animating the whole thing in layout, and it was just a matter of putting some charts down on some of the layouts.
Mm-hmm.
And when we would do the exposure sheets, you know, we had all the materials here. So you probably had about 3 or 4 weeks to do the layouts, and you would get a couple of people to do, you know, like on mine, I had like at least 3 or maybe 4 people that I would freelance the layouts to.
Mm-hmm.
And then you probably had, I think we have probably a week or two to do the direction. And at the same time, you did, you know, color key and all that stuff. And then it would go, those shorts were being, for the most part, were being done in Manila at Phil Cartoons.
Right.
And I don't know how long they would have. I do remember what the budget was, but I don't remember how long it was. And so it wasn't all that long, probably within 4 months or so. You had your, you know, from start to finish, and you had your short, it was done.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a really good budget, considering you were just doing a 7-minute short.
Do you remember the budget for those?
Yeah, $220,000.
That's pretty darn good for the time.
Exactly.
Yeah. So
I still have a copy of of the breakdown for all the different things. And I know, I'm pretty sure it says $220,000 was the total.
Right. That's an excellent budget. That's like, you had the time to do these things, almost like a Warner Brothers short. The only luxury you didn't have was that you were working on these characters over and over and over again, which, you know, kind of saves you time.
Here's the thing.
Mm-hmm.
For me, what I was doing was the people that I had worked on my shorts with people that I knew, and I knew what they could do, and they were all better than me art-wise. Like I had Mark Towser working on mine.
Yeah,
and
he's excellent.
He's retired, and he's a fantastic animator. And he did work on all of Pat Ventura's shorts.
Right.
And I also had Andy Biok, who's a great designer, and he can do layout and all that stuff. So I had guys that were really good at laying out, and Craig Kilman.
Mm-hmm.
And these guys are all good because they can animate and they're really great artists. So I had really good layouts done for my shorts. And I had, I basically art directed my own stuff when I wrote it. And I also did layouts myself on both of my shorts. So I knew what I was capable of. And if I had something that I thought was difficult, I would give it to Mark to do, because Mark he can animate anything.
Right.
So I don't know how the other people work. I did work on a lot of the other shorts, but I was just doing directing them. I would slug boards and write sheets, but not all of them did layouts. But on mine, we did layouts. So yeah, it was good, and that's probably why I think some of them turned out really as good as they did.
Do you have any questions or comments about the podcast? Please email Brian at cartoonerific.com. Your email may be featured in one of our future shows.
Well, if you haven't guessed it, this is going to be a two-parter. This is part one. Next week, we'll have part two with Robert, so please come back for that. Well, I have to say, when we're doing the interview with Robert Alvarez, there were problems at the beginning of the interview, and two different things. The sound quality wasn't there, And the unit kept shutting down. And I think it was due to a SD card issue. Robert was very gracious and very giving. And I told him what was going on. And he agreed to soldier on. And we got the technical issues solved. It had to be maybe anywhere between 45 minutes and an hour before we actually before starting the interview again. And so just want to thank Mr. Alvarez for giving us this interview. We had an issue last week with Willie Hartland as well. And I want to apologize to Willie because once again, we had a sound issue. It was basically, I think, due to the same device that we were recording it on. So anyway, Willie deserves a whole lot better. It was a fun interview. It was a good interview, but I'm going to see if we can get Willie back to maybe do another interview with better sound quality, and then we will post that up. But I just want to tell Willie that I'm very sorry that that happened. Try to be on top of this stuff. Try to make these podcasts sound as good as they can. And so, once again, I'm sorry about that. I don't know if you know, but Google Podcasts is going away. And I like Google Podcasts, but anyway, it's transitioning to YouTube Music. So if you have a subscription for this show through Google, you're probably going to have to do it through some of the service. And I'm going to make it available on YouTube Music sometime at the beginning of April. So if you want to listen to it on that, you're going to have to wait till it's available. But there's many other services that offer it. So please go to one of those services and subscribe there. Anyway, if you really like what you're listening to, please subscribe. And if you like to share this, please tell a friend or two. Let them know that you're enjoying the podcast. And we promise we're going to make it better and better. Anyway, I want to thank you all for tuning in. I want you to have a great day, a great week, and we'll see you all next time. Take care now.
This has been a Cartoonerific Studios presentation.
The Cartoonerific Podcast is copyright 2024 by Cartoonerific Studios Incorporated. All rights reserved.